Dave Perry is senior analyst at the Canadian Defense and Foreign Affairs Institute and leader of a project called Putting the Armed Back into the Canadian Armed Forces, Improving Defense Procurement in Canada. Dave, one of the elements that you looked at in this work and other work that you've done is the F-35 program. Obviously, the Canadian participation in the F-35 program is important to the United States Department of Defense. Canada, one of or the most important partner in that program. What is the current state of the art in terms of the view of the F-35 program in the Canadian government? Do they like what they see? Does the Harper administration plan to look around a little bit and decide if they want to continue in the F-35 program? Where does it stand today? Thank you for joining me, Dave.
Well, thanks very much for having me on, first off. In terms of the F-35, I guess nobody here really knows is the short answer. The government, responding to what was perceived to be a very critical auditor report, getting close to 3 years ago now, basically took that program off of its normal path and went through a complete reset. Had an independent body established, essentially the first time to do this kind of rework. Went back to first principles and basically reanalyzed the kind of work for the project that our Air Force had done. And that work was completed last spring. All of it was submitted, had independent reviews, independent assessments. And since that time, the government has essentially been sitting on the file. I think some of your listeners probably know that it's been fairly contentious here. We kind of get all the secondary spinoffs from any of the news, good or bad, that happened south of the border on that particular file. And that's been highly politically contentious, which is a lot of what led to that kind of reset initiative being undertaken with that particular file. And we're heading up to a federal election here, which is going to be no later than next October. And this is a hot-button issue that the government just simply doesn't seem to want to make any particular decisions on. They've got all the analysis. It's now been done twice, but they have yet to chart a way forward.
I see a continual stream of discussions and reports and conversations about defense acquisition reform, including the work that you've done, putting the armed back into the Canadian Armed Forces. We have a link to that at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. A lot of it seems to be driven by something called the Defense Procurement Strategy, the DPS, that came out in February 2014. Give me a thumbnail of what the point of the DPS was and where it came from, Dave.
Sure. So the there's got three components. One is leveraging defense purchases better, which has really been the central premise. The other was trying to make sure that the right equipment got into the hands of the armed forces in a timely manner. And the third part of that was streamlining procurement processes. I think at its root, this is basically driven by a couple of commissioned studies by a couple of defense industry associations in Canada, the Air Force and Space Association, and then the Canadian Defense and Security Industries Association more broadly. And that was basically those groups expressing their unhappiness and providing recommendations to government, which then led the government to actually commission its own independent study, which kind of extended that line of analysis. It was basically looking at a number of lingering problems with the way our acquisition programs were proceeding, or not, I guess is the better way of characterizing some of them, and trying to figure out ways that you could both get the system moving, but also have that produce a greater degree of economic benefit and economic leveraging for the domestic Canadian defense industries and economy.
Your report says that the DPS represents a massive shift in the way Canada acquires military equipment, but its implementation remains a work in progress. Where have the contact points been that have been difficult for your defense ministry to implement?
So one of the biggest ones that I would say off the bat is that it's not just our defense ministry that's doing the implementation. So we are relatively unique here, I think, in terms of other NATO members or developed countries, in that we actually don't have all of our authorities for defense procurement vested within the defense ministry. So the defense ministry is the budgetary authority, and they are the requirements authority. But we actually have a separate agency called Public Works and Government Services Canada, which acts as a central purchasing agent for most government goods and services, and for the acquisition of military goods specifically. So one of the big friction points has been coordination between those two bodies, as well as a third and separate ministry, which is responsible for our industrial offset projects. And the most advanced components of this strategy, which is going to actually hit its one-year anniversary this week, is integrating those three different sets of authorities and responsibilities and bringing them together. And the most challenging parts of this have been actually ironing out the details about how the domestic economic leveraging is going to take effect. And those are proposing some, and that's why the language is in there about the report about this, is proposing some pretty significant changes to move away from a system where our industrial regional benefits, which were our industrial offsets, had to be 100% of the value of an acquisition, but they were essentially applied after the analysis of an RFP or a bid had been completed. Under this new system, the actual potential for economic leveraging is actually going to be a rated and weighted requirement along with price and performance. So it's actually going to be playing a much more active role in actually determining the outcome of acquisitions than it ever has before.
And that's been explicitly laid out, my understanding is, in something called the Value Proposition Guide that the Harper administration has developed. What's been the response to that among the defense industrial base there? How do they look at that, and how do they view the expectations that they have now that they didn't have before?
So I think it's been largely positive, although they are, I think, as you would expect, always looking for more detail. This was just released not long before Christmas, and it was a long time coming. And it still, in a way, isn't really fully fleshed out, because when it was originally launched and originally conceived, the strategy was supposed to be centered around key industrial capabilities. So that was the premise at the time, and this was based on some of the independently commissioned reports the government had undertaken over the last 2 or 3 years, but that they're going to identify essentially a short list of key industrial sectors into which further spin-offs, further investment, research and development, export opportunities, involvement in global value chains, centered around some key sectors that were viewed as being economically appropriate and with a lot of development potential. They were supposed to be the focal point of this new strategy, and the government has yet to actually come up with an articulated list. I think there's a lot of reticence because you're essentially going to determine a bunch of potentially influential market sectors that they didn't make the list, and that's what's led to a lot of the reluctance to get going with that. But I think, you know, that publication of that guide as a significant step forward, because at least now industry has a better understanding about the way that these investments are going to be evaluated against price and performance. And what they were lacking before was any kind of holistic view about how these would be applied, because we've had a couple of procurements go forward since the strategy was announced last February, but they've been basically rolling out on a case-by-case basis, so there was no holistic view about what companies could expect on any future bid.
Dave Perry of the Canadian Defense and Foreign Affairs Institute has a very interesting look at the Canadian defense procurement process, and there are many lessons in it that parallel what we're dealing with in the United States, and we have a link to it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. I want to go back to the F-35 for just a moment, Dave. The Defense Industry Daily writes that Canadian officials are now questioning whether the F-35 and its mission set are relevant to Canada. Reportedly, the only other fighter contending still against the F-35 is Boeing's Super Hornet. When we listen to commentary and read about the F-35 program in this country, the takeaway normally is that it's the alternative, that there is not another alternative. And I've never heard anyone in the United States propose that the Super Hornet or any other aircraft replace it. How loud is that chatter in Canada that potentially the Hornet or some other aircraft could replace the F-35, or is it a matter of how many of these do we buy, Dave?
So the chatter's definitely been loud. I think that's a separate question than how relevant or how on point it's been. One of the things that came out of the independent analysis, which couldn't be released in full, is that the independent group that was commissioned to look at the fighter issue specifically did an independent assessment, short of an actual competition, but basically a much more detailed market assessment about what other options were out there on the marketplace, and then tried to match what they could get through that public process against the Canadian Air Force's articulation of possible mission scenarios. And one of the things that came out of that, you can read in the report because it doesn't actually attribute any of the actual aircraft information, was that essentially there was one aircraft that on one particular mission set, which was the expeditionary high-end intensity conflict scenario was demonstrably more capable than the other aircraft. And across most of the other range of missions, like counter-air defense, defensively, for instance, and sovereignty patrolling, there wasn't actually that huge of a difference between the capabilities across the four aircraft that they reviewed, which were the F-35, the Super Hornet, the Rafale, and the Eurofighter. So what that's led to, I think, and that echoes what you're saying about the, and it was in the Defense Industry Daily piece about Boeing being the other real potential significant contender, is that there's only really one kind of mission set, which for Canada has not been something that we've done all that frequently, although we're seeing this now because we're having the first ever deployment of fighter jets in an expeditionary operational capacity since the end of the Cold War, which is somewhat proving a bit of a lie to the fact that we don't do this that often. But we haven't really deployed our aircraft for much of the time in an expeditionary high-end threat scenario. I think that a lot of the discussion is kind of crystallizing around the degree to which, if there are price differences and whether or not there are or not, depending on when you buy, I think is a matter that here has not been concluded definitively. The issue is whether or not, if there is a premium, it's worth spending that for an aircraft that's particularly more capable in one particular set of scenarios, but on the whole and for what the Canadian Air Force does for the majority of its operational activity would be only a matter of a relative incremental difference.